Get informed no matter where you are or what you're doing. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now and get news when you want it on your schedule.
Big tech dominating our headlines.
Another win for Donald Trump.
A key inflation report.
These are short audio reports, 5 minutes or less, that bring you the latest headlines with context 24 hours a day. Stay on top of the latest news from around the world. Get it on your smartphone. Subscribe to Bloomberg News now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen.
Observing a dark anniversary, the American atomic bombing of Japan.
The experience of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has been always the basis of Japan's nuclear disarmament policy.
80 years later, Japan's debating nuclear weapons. I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also this hour, Israelis consider whether ultra-Orthodox Jews should serve in the military like everyone else.
Are we just carrying this wagon on our own and they're sitting in it? Why?
Plus, a bridge to Sicily.
I mean, everybody knows that this has been talked about for decades. I think that most people are skeptical that it would never happen.
The $15 billion promise from Italy's transport minister.
And how do people in Tehran cope with a heat wave?
We don't. We just sweat.
All today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thanks for being with us this August 6th.
A solemn anniversary marking 80 years since the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, hastening the end of World War II. The bomb killed 140,000 people immediately, with thousands more yet to die of injuries or illnesses caused by radiation.
In a ceremony today, the mayor of Hiroshima, Kazumi Matsui, spoke of a memory that is still visceral in his city.
核抑止力に依存する異性者の政策転換を促すことになります。
Matsui implored policymakers to stop fomenting international conflict across the globe, to stop disregarding lessons from history.
The bombings of Hiroshima and 3 days later Nagasaki were the last gasp of World War II. Hitler had already been defeated, but Japan and its forces were not surrendering and paying the price in military and civilian lives. The U.S. was also losing troops.
Air, underground, and fortified caves and holes are some of Okinawa's last defenders.
This newsreel described the bloody Battle of Okinawa in the spring of 1945.
The Yanks have fought inch by inch to conquer this 60-mile-long island. Now the end is in sight.
But the end of the war was not yet really in sight. A firebombing campaign of major Japanese cities was still to come. President Harry Truman described the damage on June 1, 1945.
Substantial portions of Japan's key industrial centers have been leveled to the ground in a series of record incendiary raids. What has already happened to Tokyo will happen to every Japanese city whose industries feed the Japanese war machine.
Truman promised destruction, but he did not mention an atomic bomb.
That historic weapon was top secret even up to a week before the U.S. dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. 80 years ago today, Truman went on air and gave the news.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
A matter-of-fact announcement followed by this explanation.
It is an atomic bomb. It is a harnessing of the basic power of the universe. The force from which the sun draws its power has been loosed.
The power has been loosed. And that power has framed our global conversations about nuclear warfare for 8 decades.
Ever since the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan's government has supported nuclear nonproliferation and disarmament. But Tokyo says the country also depends on nuclear deterrence, a protection that the United States provides to Japan. We asked Masako Toki to explain the tension around this topic inside Japan today. She's with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Middlebury Institute in Monterey, California.
When I was a high school student, I had opportunity to visit Nagasaki, and that's my first time that learn about actual impact of the nuclear weapons use. So generally speaking, many Japanese school children have opportunity to visit atomic bombing museum both in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki. Especially schools in Hiroshima and Nagasaki are very active in nuclear disarmament education. So there are strong disarmament advocacy, and it's not just nuclear disarmament policy, but it's a deeply embedded Japanese culture.
So there is a lot of education about the history of what nuclear weapons have done to Japan. Mm-hmm. How much exactly does that legacy shape Japan's current policy on nuclear weapons?
I must say that the experience of Hiroshima and Nagasaki has been always the basis of Japan's peace policy and nuclear disarmament policy, and also Japan's foreign policy. So Japan has three non-nuclear principles, which is Japan shall not possess nuclear weapons, Japan shall not manufacture nuclear weapons, and Japan shall not allow nuclear weapons on Japanese territory. And in addition to that, Japan is a strong member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as a non-nuclear weapon state, so Japan will not possess nuclear weapons. And I must say the most important aspect of Japan's defense policy, foreign policy, is U.S.-Japan Security Alliance. So Japan remains under the nuclear umbrella, so-called nuclear umbrella, so Japan is not going to develop its independent nuclear weapons.
How has that position evolved over the past 80 years? I imagine there has been some change in thought on this.
Oh, yes, of course. So while the basis has remained the same, given the volatile security environment, some people are opposing these three non-nuclear principles.
Opposing, you said?
Opposing.
What are they suggesting should be the path forward? I mean, are they suggesting that Japan should have nuclear weapons or start thinking about having nuclear weapons?
No, there might be a small group of people who support Japan's going its own nuclear weapons. With that said, like a NATO country, some people are advocating maybe Japan should host U.S. nuclear weapons on its soil. But I still really want to be very careful to say that the majority of Japanese public is really supporting Japan's disarmament policy. Almost 70% of Japanese public is supporting Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, and those people are supporting or encouraging the Japanese government to join the TPNW.
So that's interesting. So there's daylight here between public sentiment and the government. The public would like to see the abolishment of nuclear weapons. The government, with a more practical lens, says, no, we need the U.S.'s protection, and thus they need to have nuclear weapons.
That's true. Japan's official policy still continues to support eventual world free of nuclear weapons. However, as long as nuclear weapons exist, Japan wants to rely on the U.S. extended deterrence. So this tension between a nuclear disarmament advocate and Japan's reality, because Japan needs to continue to rely on U.S. extended deterrence, this is a dilemma.
It's kind of Japan stuck between a rock and a hard place here.
Yes.
As you have mentioned, though, Japan is under the so-called nuclear umbrella of the U.S. Back in March, Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshimasa Hayashi, said that nuclear deterrence is indispensable because of the severe security environment. That's similar to wording that you used. What does that mean?
Yes. So most obvious thing is that North Korea's ongoing nuclear and missile development, and also China's ongoing nuclear weapons modernization and increasing nuclear weapons capability. So Japan is always so worried about these two countries. On top of that, the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022 and some indication on using nuclear weapons by President Putin. So all those security environment really increased concern. This reality is giving a more difficult time, especially for the Japanese government, to demonstrate that Japan is really supporting nuclear deterrence. So Japanese government official document really trying to avoid mentioning Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and atomic bombing survivors from Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And also their supporters, especially people from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, are really upset about the Japanese government official policy.
Masako Toki is with the James Martin Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Middlebury Institute in Monterey, California. Ahead this hour, we visit peace parks in Hiroshima, where survivor trees are living memorials of the atomic bomb.
Their trunks are scarred from the heat of the blast, but they all have a little monument marker because they're national monuments.
That's ahead on the program.
The French government is asking people to stop getting sick so much, or at least to stop filing for all the paid sick leave they're currently allowed. Also, maybe cut back on all the holidays while they're at it. Over the past decade, France's deficit has soared, and the government is warning that if people don't start working more, it'll be hard to get the budget under control. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Embrun, France.
68-year-old former high school teacher Michel Feltes spent her last 2 years before reaching retirement age on medical leave. She was exhausted, she says, after 40 years in the classroom. She'd been working with special needs high schoolers who could at times become aggressive. I hung in there for as long as I could, she says. Then I just cracked. I became depressed. While on leave, Feltes received 100% of her salary. Stress-related cases like hers are more and more common in France. The government says paid sick leave has risen by 40% over the last decade, mainly for mental health issues. Reasons vary. Anxiety disorders have spiked post-COVID, and the French are retiring later.
Quand tu commences à atteindre un certain âge, t'as une fatigue qui s'installe.
As you get older, you can get burned out, Feltes says, and there's no flexibility in the system to reduce your hours, or in her case, she says, to combine classroom time with, say, administrative work. France says the collective bill for medical leave is now around $17 billion a year. It's trying to find ways to shorten those leaves and to crack down on abuses. But it's challenging because in France and across Europe, sick leave laws tend to favor workers over employers. French national Julie Génicot used to run a bed and breakfast on a resort island in Spain. She tells me how she once had an unhappy employee who wanted to quit, but if she did, she'd lose out on unemployment pay. So she went to the doctor and with a simple letter was granted medical leave for anxiety, Génicot recounts. I couldn't even contact her after that, she says, because under the law, I could have been accused of harassment. But Génicot did have to keep paying the employee about 75% of her salary, according to Spanish law. At the same time, she says, she had to hire a temporary replacement. After nearly a year of shouldering the extra costs, I ran out of money, she says. I had to close the inn. Spain also hopes to crack down or put limits on sick leave. Ditto for Germany, the EU country with the most workers out ill per year. France's plan so far, to reduce how much it pays workers for each day ill and to give employers more power to challenge potentially phony claims. In the meantime, France's Prime Minister, François Bayrou, has thrown out another idea to compensate for the lost time.
Il faut travailler plus. Je propose donc
the French must work more, he declared recently. I propose eliminating two of France's 11 paid holidays a year, say Easter Monday or Victory in World War II Day. But he said he's open to other suggestions. So I asked some French people, if you had to axe two holidays, which would you choose?
Aucun.
None, says geography professor Fred Richard. In fact, he says, studies show that people spend more money on days off, which helps the economy. This is just a provocation. But if I really had to, Richard says, I'd nix Christmas or Easter. Cue up the controversy. At least among two French nieces of mine.
On est réunis avec la famille et c'est important.
Christmas is my favorite holiday, says 10-year-old Chloé, because it is the day that brings together the whole family. They can't take that away.
Parce qu'on reçoit plein de cadeaux, un faux chien.
It's when we get presents, says 7-year-old Charlotte, like a stuffed animal dog or a play computer. I quickly assure the girls that no one's pulling the plug on old Saint Nick, but as for getting more details from the French government on the holiday erasing, that'll have to wait until September. France's National Assembly closes in July and August. Most members go on vacation, using up some of their allotment of 45 days off per year. For the World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Embrun, France.
Coming up, Israel's mandatory draft law isn't actually for everyone, and that is a source of deep controversy there. Our story is just ahead. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. At Jerusalem's Western Wall, the Israeli army held a swearing-in ceremony today for troops from a special ultra-Orthodox brigade. They are the first Haredim, or ultra-Orthodox, to serve in the IDF. The brigade was created to show that it's possible to be rigorously observant while also serving in the military. That is the subject of an increasingly heated political debate in Israel. Historically, ultra-Orthodox Jews have been exempt from military service. But as Robbie Berman reports from Tel Aviv, there's growing pressure to end the exemption.
In 1948, the year Israel was founded, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion allowed 400 ultra-Orthodox Talmudic scholars exemption from military service. Ultra-Orthodox Rabbi Yehoshua Pfeffer is chairman of Netzach Yehuda, an organization that supports ultra-Orthodox Jews serving as soldiers in the IDF.
From the inception of the State of Israel, Haredim received an exemption for Torah students from army service, which was set to allow Haredi society to rehabilitate, to rebuild the world of religion, of Torah study, the yeshivas, and so on, that was decimated in the Holocaust.
These army exemptions were also granted because Ben-Gurion wanted to induce the ultra-Orthodox political parties to support his fledgling government coalition.
Initially, we're talking about 400 or 500 boys who were exempt from IDF duty. Today, something like 14,000 boys turn 18 every year.
Today, there are more than 80,000 Haredim, as the ultra-Orthodox are referred to, who are of army age and are not serving, causing massive public protest.
Why do we see more young men going? Because there's a strong social cost that you pay in that. And you have to think about how will this impact siblings? How will this impact families? How will that impact your shidduch, your matchmaking capacities? How will it impact your standing in the society and your parents' standing and so on and so forth?
I'm now in Bnei Brak, one of the largest ultra-Orthodox cities in Israel, where most of the residents here don't serve in the IDF. I spoke with Moshe, who is 29 years old, married with two children. He studies Torah all day long and refuses to serve. Look, they call the army a melting pot, and we don't want to melt, he says. We want to preserve who we are, and we're being loyal to God. The secular talk about equality, even in the army there is no equality. Not everyone becomes a combat fighter. Some are sent to the IDF choir unit. Some are sent to the IDF press unit. Well, I'm in the learning Torah unit. Moshe, who wouldn't give me his last name, says there is no way a religious soldier can serve in the army and remain religious. How can I go to the army when most soldiers have smartphones that they can easily access pornography? My brother, who went to the so-called religious ultra-Orthodox IDF unit, came out as an atheist. To me, Moshe says, it is better if a religious person would die at a young age than live a long life as an atheist. What Hitler did to the Jewish people physically, the State of Israel is doing to the Jewish people spiritually. While this tension has been around for decades, after 2 years of war with Hamas and 800 dead IDF soldiers, it has reached a boiling point. Rabbi Pfeffer feels the ultra-Orthodox are playing a dangerous game.
If the Haredi leadership doesn't say that those who are not in full-time Torah study have to serve in the army now, I think that the resentment and the opposition to the Haredim from Israel's population could be deeply, deeply damaging.
Every week in Tel Aviv, there are massive protests against the government, against the war, and against the planned legislation to permanently exempt Haredim from serving in the army. Shelley, who asked not to share her last name, says exempting one segment of Israeli society from the army is unacceptable.
We are a democratic, liberal country. That's what the State of Israel was founded on. Everyone has equal rights and equal duties, and they're welcome to believe whatever they want. And they can go study as much as they want after they've done their service, just like our children have to do their service. They have to do their 3 years, and then they can go study whatever they want.
Shelley says she thinks she understands the real reason why the ultra-Orthodox don't want their children to serve in the army.
Fighting a war, I don't think, is fun for anybody. Being nervous, being worried about your loved ones is not fun. So if you have an easy way out, why not? I don't think it has anything to do with Torah. I think that is just an excuse. It's a very human thing to not want to fight wars. And this is what they're taking advantage of.
Chedva, who also didn't want her last name used, is a mother of three children, one of them currently serving as a soldier in the IDF.
My daughter is 22. And she stopped counting how many funerals she's been to of people her age, you know, close relationships that have been killed, and also suicide. So this is something that the Orthodox are not experiencing. And why? Are we just carrying this wagon on our own and they're sitting in it? Why?
The Supreme Court issued a ruling last year that Haredim must be drafted. To fight this, the religious political parties are demanding the Knesset pass legislation to give them a permanent exemption. When the United Torah Judaism Party withdrew from the governing coalition 2 weeks ago, it left Netanyahu with a razor-thin majority of just one seat. Now Shas, the last ultra-Orthodox party remaining in the coalition, is also threatening to leave the government over the exemption law, and if that happens, it will topple the government. Nimrod Shefer, the former chief of staff of the Israeli Air Force and a leading figure in a new left-wing political party called the Democrats, says the summer recess in the Knesset will temporarily push off the crisis for Netanyahu.
When they reconvene in the Knesset in October, the talks about the end of the government will enter another phase. I think most chances are that by March next year, we will be facing general elections in Israel.
One thing is for sure, moving forward and staying in power for Netanyahu will be extremely challenging. For The World, I'm Robbie Berman in Tel Aviv.
Three people at a U.S. research base in Antarctica were evacuated for urgent medical care this week, an event the New Zealand Herald has called a daring midwinter rescue. It was New Zealand that responded to a request for help issued by the U.S. National Science Foundation.
It is winter in the Southern Hemisphere, so getting people out of Antarctica right now is a risky and rare kind of operation. The combination of freezing temperatures and complete darkness at all hours means landing a plane there is one of the most technologically challenging tasks an air team can face.
The Royal New Zealand Air Force executed the rescue mission at McMurdo Station yesterday. New Zealand frequently serves as the launching point for deployments to McMurdo. It took 20 hours for the crew of the C-130 Hercules to evacuate the three patients. Temperatures at McMurdo Station fell to negative 11 degrees Fahrenheit yesterday. The plane landed in Christchurch, New Zealand this morning, where the three are getting medical treatment.
From surviving in extreme cold to coping with extreme heat, just ahead, Iran has been sweltering for days. We check in with one Tehran resident about how people there are coping. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Tehran, Iran's capital, water taps are beginning to run dry. An ongoing water shortage has prompted authorities to shutter government offices today. That order isn't just for the capital, but also for about half the country's provinces, one effort to address the water shortage. It will not, however, fill up Tehran's shrinking reservoirs. A lack of rain and now a blistering heat wave have stressed the country's infrastructure to the breaking point. To hear what it's like there now, we caught up with a musician and composer in Tehran, someone who's joined us on the show before. We're not stating his name to protect his safety.
When the electricity goes out, which it goes out regularly, at least 2 hours per day, the water doesn't come out of the faucet. So it's extremely difficult and putting a lot of pressure on everybody's mind.
And with electricity going down, as you mentioned, in a blistering heat wave, is that making access to air conditioning difficult right now?
Oh, yes. Oh, tell me about it. I mean, we are lucky that Tehran is a little bit cooler than the south of Iran, but in total, everything is very hard.
I've heard that temperatures got as high as 122 degrees Fahrenheit the other day. What does that feel like?
Feels like hell. And just imagine you go home from work and the electricity is cut and you live on the fifth floor. And you have to walk all the way up, and there is no air conditioning, and the staircases have direct sunlight, so you kind of bake, really.
What are you thinking? What are you feeling as this is going on?
Ever since the start of the Islamic Republic.
In 1979?
Yes. There have always been shortages for one thing or the other. So they have kind of conditioned people that there is always a shortage. And I have friends who work for private companies, and they say that, you know, when electricity goes out, the day is over, it's almost closed. And since Tehran also have rich people, many of them connected to the system, the nouveau rich family, when you go to the most expensive restaurants, they're always there celebrating with their Bugattis and their Mercedeses and all these things, and they don't care about anything.
You were saying shortages have been the norm in Iran since the beginning of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, but have you experienced heat like this before in Tehran? And how have people in Iran reacted to these shortages of water and electricity in this heat wave?
It's like Murphy's Law, in a way. When it rains, it pours. Or, I mean, the other way. When it doesn't rain, then you don't have electricity either. So, in a way, we did have hot summers before. We had dry winters before. But one thing which I frankly don't understand, except if we consider the ruling or the rulers of Iran as non-Iranians, is like we look at them as occupiers, which they don't really care about the country, even if their children are, half of them are here and half of them are in Canada and the U.S. Anyway, but so they don't really care.
You talk about the shortages. Tehran has not had this little rainfall for 60 years. The five big reservoirs around the capital, as you know, have shrunk to small ponds. How unusual is that?
Yeah. It is very unusual.
So how often do your taps or those of friends or relatives run dry right now?
At least 2 hours per day right now. But I have a little studio out of Tehran. I mean, it's a small village and the whole water is cut. And electricity goes out sometimes 7 hours per day.
So I saw a video online of what looks like a cash machine, but it's actually a machine that dispenses drinking water for a fee. You slip in your bank card, you get a cup of water. Have you seen that? Do those exist?
Is dispensing machines, I mean, it's just another way of making money out of people, of people's misery. Because, I mean, right now, you can go to a grocery store and buy a six-pack of water, of mineral water, which is more expensive than a liter of gasoline.
Wow. Who or what are Tehran residents blaming for this worsening crisis? Do people see it as nature causing this problem or something else?
Everything is because of the mismanagement of the ruling regime, and the whole thing just has collapsed. The root is that the country has been run by fifth graders since 1979. When it comes to public safety and concerns and an economy, so they don't hire or they don't put people with experience and education on important area. Their only criteria is that they are dedicated to the leader. That's it. So that creates a lot of corruption.
But like on a day-to-day basis, you encounter these taps that are shut off, air conditioning doesn't work because the electricity is there. Just practically speaking, how do you stay cool and hydrated?
We don't. We just sweat. That's all we can do. When we cannot do anything, we go to the mountains. And it's a little bit drier, but at least it's cooler. And we just stay, we try to stay in the shade as much as we can.
That's one resident of Tehran describing the current record heat wave and water shortage in Iran. We're not stating his name to protect his safety.
The Italian government has greenlit plans for a bridge from mainland Italy to Sicily, more than 2 miles offshore. In an announcement today, Transport Minister Matteo Salvini called it the biggest infrastructure project in the West. The idea is to cut travel time across the Strait of Messina from the hour and a half it currently takes to ride the ferry down to 10 minutes by car. But it comes with a hefty price tag, $15.5 billion. Italy says the bridge is necessary for national security. Opponents say that makes the bridge a military target. Plus, there are other concerns like the environmental impact of the project. But as the world's Jeremy Siegel first reported in the fall, this isn't the first time Italians have dreamed of a bridge over the Strait of Messina, nor is it the first debate about it.
The first idea for a bridge over the Strait of Messina, the narrow body of water between Sicily and southern Italy, can be traced back to Roman times. Philosopher and military commander Pliny the Elder wrote of a plan to create a makeshift bridge by connecting a series of boats. That never happened, the first in a series of abandoned plans.
I mean, everybody knows that this has been talked about for decades. I think that most people are skeptical that it would never happen.
Daniele Albertazzi is a politics professor at the University of Surrey. He says after the Romans, there were a few other times the idea of a bridge came up again. The government looked into the feasibility of a structure in the 70s and even began envisioning possible designs. The big push for it came in the 90s and early 2000s under then Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. He actually got as far as drilling a few preliminary holes for the structure, but
all of this was actually blocked and stopped in 2013 by a successive government, mainly for lack of funds.
Now, there's a new push for the bridge, with a new person at its center.
Questa si propone di essere la più grande opera pubblica.
That is Matteo Salvini, Italy's Minister of Infrastructure and Transportation, and leader of the country's most radical right-wing party, Brothers of Italy. He's describing in a press conference how he's reviving a centuries-old dream.
Riattivato quello che è un sogno di milioni di italiani.
At more than 2 miles in length, it would be a record-breaking suspension bridge, and it's a daunting project for several reasons. First off, the bridge will go directly over a massive fault line that caused the worst earthquake in Italian history in 1908, killing tens of thousands of people.
It was a big tragedy.
Gianluca Valencia is a leading Italian seismologist. He says the 7.5 magnitude quake should serve as a warning, but super long bridges, like the Bridge of Messina, actually fare pretty well during seismic activity.
They act as a filter with respect to the earthquake. The earthquake comes, it may destroy the buildings around the bridge, but not the bridge itself.
Still, the fault has been the source of pushback, as has the price tag. Many Sicilians say they'd rather see that money go toward fixing existing infrastructure problems on the island. There's also environmental advocates who worry construction could be detrimental to the region's biodiversity. On top of all of that, there's the more abstract threat of whether history is doomed to repeat itself.
I started to work for the Messina Bridge 50 years ago.
Giorgio Diana is one of the original designers of the bridge and played an integral role in making sure it was safe from intense wind. Now nearing the age of 90, he hopes he'll actually see it built.
It's a too long time that I am working on Messina, and this is the third time that we are very close to the starting the construction. So it's a very old story.
An old story that could get a new chapter quite soon. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
According to the Italian Transport Minister's announcement today, initial work on the bridge could begin in September or October, with construction expected to start next year, the target completion date, 2033.
If you grew up in China, Hong Kong, Japan, or most any other country in Asia in the 1970s or 1980s, then this is a familiar sound. The music of Teresa Tung. She was the big pop star in Asia at the time. Tung was born in Taiwan in 1953 and already well on her way to stardom at age 14 when she dropped out of school to be a musician. By the late 70s, Tung was touring throughout Asia, releasing hit after hit. Tung's career ground to a halt in the 1990s as her health deteriorated. She died from an asthma attack at age 42 in 1995. Her funeral in Taipei was a big production, with many fans lining up to pay their respects in person and others watching on TV. It was televised throughout Asia. It's been 30 years since then, but Teresa Tung fans are excited because a previously unreleased recording of her has just been discovered, and now it is out. It's called Love Songs Are Best in the Foggy Night. Shen Da Huang is a fan who is excited by this new release. He is also a PhD student at UCLA who studies Chinese pop culture. Shen Da, what was your reaction when you heard that this long-lost recording from Teresa Tang was being released?
Well, I mean, I'm so excited. It's very, very rare for a pop icon who has been passed away for 30 years and she can still offer some new materials for her fans and for all the listeners who listen to her throughout the world.
What is the story behind its release 30 years after her death?
Teresa Tung is a great Asian pop star, and her music kind of bridges a memory between people across different countries. So, I mean, she's truly someone who kind of bridged the Asian culture between China, Japan, and across East Asia. This song offers some new message for today's audience across the world.
How she bridged those different cultures. She was huge across Asia, as you mentioned.
Yes.
Why was she so popular, you know, kind of across all these countries?
Yeah, I mean, first, she was born in Taiwan in 1953, and she rose to fame across East and Southeast Asia in 1970s and 1980s. And one of the most notable aspects is she can speak more than seven languages, including Mandarin, Cantonese, Japanese, Malaysia, English, and more. And she recorded more than 1,700 songs in multiple languages. And she has traveled to every country in Asia, as well as in US, Europe, you know, Thailand, to perform for millions of listeners. So I think that made her one of the great, you know, transcultural Asian pop icons throughout the world.
So she was born and grew up in Taiwan. She was ethnically Chinese, and she was, as you mentioned, incredibly popular there. This was at a time when China was starting to open up its markets and allow in cultural influences from other countries.
Yes.
Why was she so popular specifically there, and how did that historical moment kind of help rocket her to fame?
I mean, first, consider most of the Chinese in mainland China experience listen to her music in a smuggling underground ways, maybe secret. At first, the Chinese government, although they call it reform and opening, this is like a step by step. So they are very carefully censoring Teresa Tung's music in the early 1980s. But due to her immense popularity, And the leaders of the party gradually found that her music was pretty good. It is such a great piece of work that's kind of promoting the traditional Chinese poetry. So her songs, her music are getting more and more official acceptance in late 1980s. So she becomes such a great icon in billions of listeners in mainland China.
I'm speaking to Shenda Huang about the legacy of Taiwanese pop star Teresa Teng. A recently discovered recording of Teng's has just been released 30 years after her death. Let's listen to a bit more of her music that was released during her life. Here she is performing the song, When Will You Return? It is a cover of a song first made famous by Chinese singer Zhou Shuwen in 1937.
It's very interesting. Teresa Teng offered a new image of Chinese femininity in a soft, sentimental, yet emotionally expressive and powerful in a quiet way, as we heard from this song. So it was very rare in like Chinese music and gender history, and it had a lasting impact on female representation in Chinese pop music.
Shenda, when did you become a fan of Teresa Teng's music? Did you listen to it growing up? Like, were your parents fans?
Of course. I first heard Teresa Teng as a child. And over time, her songs become part of my personal playlist. And for the generation of my parents who grew up like listening to Teresa Teng's music in 1980s, 1990s, my parents, they get married and they play Teresa Teng's music at their weddings.
Do you have a favorite Teresa Teng song?
Yeah, I would say The Moon Represents My Heart. Kind of so soft, sentimental, and it's just as if she was like a friend who is vividly sharing her story with you through melodies.
Shenda Huang is a PhD student at UCLA and a Teresa Teng super fan. He was telling us about a newly released song by the late singer, Love Songs Are Best in the Foggy Night.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We've been marking the 80th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima today. The blast destroyed two-thirds of the Japanese port city, instantly killing about 140,000 people. The focus at memorials in Hiroshima today was the lives lost, but there are also visual scars in this city, testaments to survival. 159 trees that were nearly vaporized in the bombing but have grown back over the past 80 years.
For National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek, the survivor trees in Hiroshima are living symbols of the city's history. He passed through Hiroshima on foot as part of the Out of Eden Walk. The National Geographic Project traces a path of human migration across the globe. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, Marco. It's good to be back.
Set the scene for us in Hiroshima. What does this area of the city look like?
The whole downtown, they call the hypocenter, where the bomb fell, is a series of kind of interlocking peace parks, memorial parks, and so they're green spaces. And there's one ruined building that's been left standing, this famous domed building, as a monument to the blast back in 1945.
And the trees, are they kind of scattered throughout these peace parks or just one of them?
Yeah, no, they're scattered throughout, including in some streets beyond. I mean, you just see this big old tree standing around, and it's, you know, often they're leaning. Sometimes they have scarred surfaces. Their trunks are scarred from the heat of the blast. But they all have a little monument marker because they're national monuments in Japan, each one of these 159 trees.
That is remarkable. Now, you write about the arborist who takes care of these trees. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Mr. Chikara Horiguchi was 80, and he had been taking care of the trees. That was his job for the city for more than 30 years. And he sort of treated them like family patients. He was very devoted to them. He had very thick binders full of charts about their condition. He would check on them, you know, over a period of time, trying to keep them alive as long as possible. He was saying that their roots, Marco, even today, grow away from where the bomb blast was targeted. It's very strange. Even underground, there's this kind of wounding. Yeah.
So in our conversations, Paul, you speak about people being the focus and purpose of your walk around the planet, but your project and trees have something in common. Trees have long lives and show how things change over very long periods of time, longer than a human lifetime for sure. How did it feel to lay eyes on these trees that symbolize, frankly, one of the darkest moments in human history?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. The motto of my project is that people are my destination, but I often write about the environment, you know, the climate crisis, environmental change, etc. But what struck me about this aspect of the story is that we have these creatures, these organisms, these beings that are like silent witnesses. They can't talk, right? You can walk up to them, you can lay your hand on their trunks. And in some ways, that's as powerful as being told the story of what happened that apocalyptic day. They're kind of, in their silence, they carry power.
So you said you spoke with some of the survivors of the atomic bomb the U.S. dropped on Hiroshima. What stories did they tell you?
You know, the Hibakusha, as they're called, A-bomb survivors, many of them were just children, the ones that are still alive, right? They're in their 80s, in some cases 90s. I interviewed one man who was in utero. I mean, he was, you know, in his mother's womb and when he experienced the shockwaves. And yet their lives have been, as you would imagine, irrevocably changed by this event. Like a hole has blown through their lives for a lot of complicated reasons that I get into in the story.
What did you hear from younger Japanese about this event? Like folks who were born in the generation since 1945, like what does a bombing mean to them?
You know, that's really the kernel of the story that I wrote. It's about, you know, the power of memory, but also how does memory change from these catastrophic events, mass violence of war? Japanese that I interviewed who were older, the Hibakusha, the survivors, often would lament that younger people just don't appreciate, and of course can't appreciate, that kind of tragedy anymore. They get a bit of it in their history books, in their school textbooks. There's a famous manga about it that was written in the 70s, manga comic book, right? But they say that they struggle constantly to make it real for young Japanese who lead as lives that as distracted as anybody's today, right, in our modern world.
How does that make the older generation feel?
You know, I interviewed one of the leaders of the peace activist groups of A-bomb survivors in Japan who won the Nobel last year, right? This group, Nihon Hidyankyo. I interviewed one of the main activists about it, Mr. Toshiyuki Mimaki. And he was actually, you know, surprisingly dejected. He had spent decades of his life fighting. They've been trying to ban nuclear weapons, right? To get nukes, you know, off the face of the earth. That's a Herculean task today. And it's even more depressing, Marco, for them now because there seems to be proliferation, right? Look at what's happening in Iran. Look at North Korea. Israel, of course, has nukes. So I think there was a sense of a mixed feeling of pride among these survivors, but also tempered by kind of a sobering realization that this haunting problem, this cataclysmic problem is still very much with us.
For many Americans, as you know, the name Hiroshima is synonymous with this one horrific event of its history. Did you get a sense that that history still defines Hiroshima, or does a city have a modern identity as well?
This is something I reflect on as well, walking through. My project's on foot, so I have time to kind of absorb cities like Hiroshima. I enter from the outskirts, you know, maybe paddy fields, hamlets, villages, go into the outskirts and then walked into the center, crossing these big, busy traffic bridges. Hiroshima is noted for its rivers. It has six or seven rivers running through it. And it's very modern. It's got malls. It's got, you know, funky, chic coffee shops. Looking at this city through the modern prism, it's very much leading its own life right now. If you didn't go to the memorial parks downtown, you would see no evidence that it was, two-thirds of it was wiped out by a nuclear blast 80 years ago.
Interesting. Well, 2025, and once again, nuclear weapons are being spoken of. How did being in Hiroshima change your perspective on nuclear weapons or armed conflict generally?
You know, I'm a former war reporter myself, and I've covered, you know, human cruelty often. It was very strange, very surreal, and very sobering to still see these problems kind of very much manifest in these monuments. These were the paradox, the irony is that they're presented as peace monuments, right? Of course, which they have to be. We have to grab onto hope. Even these trees, these survivor trees, are kind of icons of hope and resilience. But as I left Hiroshima, I must say it was not in an up mood. It was you know, pretty depressing given the state of the world.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek. As always, Paul, thank you.
Thank you, Marco. Always a pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Steve Henn, Dan Shee and Ted McGovern, Sharon G. and Robert L. Ryan, and Frederica and Howard Stevenson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PRX.